This is David Price, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee via Skype on the 21st of February 2013. David Price, Part 1.
David Michael Price, my date of birth 16th of October 1935, and I was born in Barclay in Gloucestershire.
So how old are you now, David?
I'm 77.
Okay.
Coming up 78 in October.
I've read your book with interest, but just for the record, would you say your father was an educated man?
My father?
Yeah.
Not particularly, because he was deaf, and that caused him a few problems.
How was that for you then as a child, communicating with a father who couldn't hear?
Well, he wasn't stone deaf as such, totally deaf, but we got along okay. And I think that with that sort of deafness, one gets used to the tone of a person's voice and makes it easier to understand.
So you learnt early on in life how to communicate, did you?
I suppose so. He was a clever man, but not an educated man.
In what way was he clever?
Well, he was very good at designing and making things, particularly electrical equipment and things like that.
Did he run his own company for a while?
He did.
Yeah, tell me about that.
He worked as an electrical maintenance engineer in a dockyard at the early part of the war. But he decided that he wanted to do more for the war effort than he was seemingly to achieve. And he, because of his deafness, he had trouble with telephones and things like that. So he left and started his own company.
Doing what, David?
Well, he set up a small factory for producing brush gear for generators for a company called, he was a subcontractor to a company called Maudsley in Dursley, and they were major contractors to the Admiralty.
Was he employing lots of people?
Not a lot of people. I mean, it was a very low-key and small operation of about, I suppose, eight women, all women actually, because all the men had gone to war, and the women had to do the job, and he taught them how to use lathes and drilling machines and how to do the assembly of the equipment and things like that. And he had a very big garage at the end of our drive, and it was all set up in there.
So he was clearly a resourceful man then, to be able to do all that without the benefit of hearing.
That's right, he was.
Do you spot anything in this episode in your childhood that kind of shaped your later life?
No, not really. I suppose it all harks back to the Price family, really, because they were all Bristol Channel pilots. They were all resourceful men, agents of their own destiny to a large extent, had all done their apprenticeships and got their mates and masters tickets under sail. So they were a pretty tough lot.
But I'm thinking also of the resourcefulness of being your own boss and employing people and dealing with them, whether you felt that you learnt early on in life that resourcefulness was a useful attribute.
Yes, I suppose I did, really. I mean, I was exposed to it an awful lot just in my sort of formative years. Mm. So, yes, I suppose it did.
But you were also very much a country lad, weren't you?
Oh, yes. I mean, where we lived was in deep country in the Vale of Barclay. I don't know if you've ever been to Barclay, but...
This is Gloucestershire?
Yes.
And with a famous castle?
It's got a castle there, and it's right on the River Severn.
Yeah.
And there's a small port there, which is called Sharpness. The ships used to come up and down the Bristol Channel to that, and that's where the family came in as pilots, Bristol Channel pilots. And, of course, Sharpness became very important during the war effort, and the Americans came during the war, and they started shipping stuff in for D-Day, stockpiling equipment and things like that.
Tell me a bit about your schooling, David.
My schooling? Well, I went to the local primary school when I was a lad, and then it was a case of the 11-plus exam, and I ended up in Lidney Grammar School, which is on the other side of the Severn, in the Forest of Dean.
Which resulted in a rather unusual journey to school.
By train. There was a bridge across the Severn at Sharpness in those days. It has now been demolished. But we used to go on the Great Western Railway on the train. There was quite a number of us went across the river each day. I think I crossed the river, I calculated something like 2,200 times during my school years.
Was it the same every day?
Well, no, the river was always changing. Sometimes the tide was in, sometimes the tide was out. Of course, being a river estuary, you got all sorts of changeable weather conditions and things like that. And it was a very picturesque journey anyway.
But what was it like on a really bad day, though? Because it was. I've seen photographs of this viaduct, and it is jolly exposed, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It used to. The wind used to blow up through there a fair bit, so it was fairly windy. It was a good day to keep the window shut on the railway carriage.
What sort of subjects did you do well at school?
Oh, now, let me see. I did very well at English and geography and history and parts of mathematics. I wasn't very good at Latin, and I wasn't very good at French.
There's no mention of metalwork or woodwork in that. Did you have lessons
with
your
hands? Well, we did. There was woodwork in the curriculum, but it wasn't given a lot of emphasis, and I didn't take a lot of interest in it.
Right.
My main interest in that regard was generated by my father's workshop. He always had lathes and things like that, so I got to learn how to play around with those when I was quite young.
So was there a sense of inevitability that you might end up in engineering in one form or another?
Oh, I was always going to be an engineer. Yes.
Was there an attraction above just doing what your dad did?
No, not really, I don't think. I went to Listers and did my apprenticeship. That's where most of the young fellows who were interested in engineering went, simply because it was so convenient.
Yeah.
And it was easy to get to every day.
Well, Listers was in Dursley, wasn't it? And I think it was
quite
a large outfit at that time.
Yes, during the war and just after, and when I was there. It employed something like about 3,000 people, which is pretty small beer, I suppose, by some standard. But in the deep fastnesses of Gloucestershire, it was a big deal.
Tell me a bit more about the apprenticeship. Was it a tough time for a young lad?
Oh, well, the pressure was on. I mean, this was before the days of what they called sandwich courses and things like that. You were expected to start work at 7:30 in the morning and go to night school about 3 or 4 nights a week. So your day started at about bright and early, so that you could get to work by 7:30, and you didn't get home again until about 10 p.m.
And I presume it was a broad-based training.
Oh, very much so, yes. Very much so.
Do you remember some of the things you were taught to do?
Oh, well, I mean, we learnt all about machine shop things and things like that, operating machines, and I spent a lot of time in the drawing office and Lister's always maintained that as well as teaching us engineers, they taught us how to work, which which meant they got their pound of flesh out of us, I suppose. And they also told us that we had to learn to take orders if we were expecting later on in life to give orders to others.
So was it a good grounding then for later life?
Oh, I think it was. Actually, it had a reputation of being a very good engineering apprenticeship, yes.
And doubtless you're expected to then stay at the company and kind of pay back the apprenticeship.
Well, no, that was the funny thing. I mean, I stayed on doing an extracurricular course, if you like, for 2 years after my apprenticeship finished. But then in those days, we had to get out and do our national service, either in the Army or Air Force, or to go into the Merchant Navy as a marine engineer. And that was the course I chose. But of course, if you've read the books, you'll know that Fidge came along, and that attracted me, and so I joined them.
So you never made it to the Merchant Navy?
Not to the Merchant Navy, no.
No, in the, I mean, I'm in national service, I mean.
No, not at all. When I got back from FIDS, there was a nice letter from the War Office or whoever dealt with those things, telling me that as I had been south, they thought that I'd done my duty by the country, and I could consider myself exempt from national service.
Do you remember whether that arrangement was made before you went south, or whether it was agreed after you came back?
Well, I came back, and the letter was there waiting for me when I came back. So I suppose the wheels of whatever it was, turned around whilst we were away, and they said, "Well, this is where this lad is," and
Okay.
that was it. And I mean, it wasn't just me. I suppose there were lots of others as well, like that.
There were indeed quite a few chaps who took the Southern option rather than the National Service option, yeah. So
Yeah.
the fact that you joined FIDS came about in a rather unusual way because Lister got an unexpected contract, which I'd like you to tell me about, please.
Well, I was an applications design engineer working with special contracts. And one day my boss came up to me and dropped a file on my desk and said, "Have a look at this." He said, "I think it'll be right up your alley," because I had a bit of a reputation in Lister's for going off climbing and doing things like that at the weekends. And most often on a Friday, I'd turn up to work with a bulging rucksack and a pair of boots and a saucepan hanging off the back. And they used to call me Sherpa as a nickname. So he thought that something to do with the Antarctic would appeal to me. And that's how I got to know all about FIDS and what was happening there.
So, what was the job that was inside this folder?
Oh, well, it was to design all the generating equipment as a power station for Port Lacroix.
Port Lacroix at that time was an ionospheric, so it was going to be an
That's right, yeah.
ionospheric station for the
Yes.
International Geographical Year. But
Yes,
which was, sorry.
and the Year of International Geophysical Cooperation, which followed on from the IGY.
Both of which were pretty high profile, so this is quite an important commission, wasn't it?
Well, it was really, yes. It was indeed.
So what did you have to
And
do to, in what way did you adapt Lister's existing products to make them serviceable in such an alien environment?
well, I mean, nothing much really, because they were extremely robust and reliable pieces of equipment, which is one of the shortcomings that they were suffering from with the existing equipment they had. and we just modified the engines to have an auxiliary sump, lubricating oil sump, so that the engines could run for about 3 weeks without stopping, 24/7. And then having two generators, I just swapped from one to the other and do a bit of maintenance as required on the one that was shut down, and let the other one take over, and then 3 weeks later do another swap.
So in the design process, preparing these generators to go south, did you have to take into account the coldness of the in Antarctic?
Oh, yes, but the engines were designed in such a way that they would start in very low ambient temperatures, and the ambient temperatures we had at Port Lockroy wasn't sufficiently low to cause them any problems.
Was it more or less in a case of taking two machines off the peg, or was there more to it than that?
Oh, with a few modifications. I mean, the switchboards and things like that were special because of the nature of the sets, and we kept one of the old Enfield sets as well, so there were three sets of instrumentation on a switchboard and things like that.
Do you remember how it was that Dursley got the contract? Because they weren't using Lister generators before that point.
No, that's right. But Lister's did a lot of work with Crown Agents, and Crown Agents did a lot of the buying for agencies such as FIDS. And so I suppose it came to Lister's, came out to tender to Lister's.
And if you'd said no, what would have happened?
If Lister's had said no.
Well, if you said, I don't want to do the job.
Oh, well, one didn't do that sort of thing.
Fair comment.
No, you just looked at the job. It looked very interesting, especially the environmental conditions and the fact that once the engines were built and tested at Dursley, they all had to be stripped down into their component parts and shipped out as a pile of parts.
Yeah.
And reassembled back together again at Port Lockroy. Now, it was part of the contract that Lister's second an engineer to go to Port Lockroy to rebuild these engines and to commission them on site. But Lister's declined to do so. I don't know why. So I thought, this is a good idea, so I stuck up my hand to FIDS, and we started talking from there.
So how did that happen then? Did you have to resign from Lister's?
I did, yes, but it was a very benign sort of resignation. Whilst I was down there, one of the directors took me under his wing and wrote me letters and kept me up to date with what was happening, so it was never considered that I was permanently leaving the nest, even though in my mind I certainly was, because there was a wider world out there and I wanted to see part of it.
So the key factor was that it was not Lister's who were paying your salary to go south, but somebody else.
That's right.
Yeah. Knowing then that you were likely to go down to the Antarctic with these machines, I would imagine you took great care in choosing spare parts to go with them, didn't you?
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. And there was a list of recommended spare parts which, you know, the company would produce for Lloyds and people like that, for marine engines that were on ships. And it was based around those sort of requirements. And also Lister's themselves had a list of spares for these remote places, maybe for 12 months operation, or another list for a more comprehensive for, say, 2 years operation. So it was all built around that.
So Lister's, in fact, were already supplying engines to other remote parts of the world, were they?
Oh, well, you can go anywhere you like in the world, you'd find Lister engines. specifically in the remote parts where they needed particularly power generation or water pumping, things like that. You'd find them in the deserts of Africa. You'd find them in the Australian outback. For instance, I know that in the states of South Australia and the Northern Territory, which is just the middle part of Australia, there was over 17,000 Lister engines in that area alone, just driving pumps or generators. You find them everywhere. They were ubiquitous.
So reliability was a most important factor.
That's right.
Yeah. You were uniquely placed, of course, to approach FIDS, but did you have to go through the usual interview process?
Well, that was the understanding. Justice had to be seen to be done.
Yeah.
And so they said that they would treat me as though it was a normal application.
Do you remember the interview at all?
Oh, not a lot. I know that there were, I was asked a few questions, most of which I could answer. They were very concerned about me because on my referees, two of the referees I nominated were both clergymen, and they thought that I was going down there on a missionary trip. I don't know who they thought I was going to convert, but I assured them that that wasn't the case. These people happened to be family friends.
And was there a medical, Dave?
Was it what?
Was there a medical?
Yes. Yes, there was. And they said it was a good job that I was going to Port LaCroix because the Harley Street specialist that we were sent to had detected a heart murmur with me, which was the first I'd ever heard about it. And so Port LaCroix being a static base, I wouldn't be exposed to any strenuous long sledging journeys and things like that. But nothing untowards happened, of course.
But your appointment was still not in any doubt, despite that
discussion. Oh, no, I don't think... Well, I don't know. I mean, FIDS... I read articles and things that other people have written about FIDS, and not one of them really got told that they were going until the last minute. I'm sure you would have come across that from other people you've interviewed. And certainly they hung on, but they rang me at Lister's one day and said, you're on, get down to Southampton on October the 1st or something.
So do you remember how much warning you had?
I think it might have been a full fortnight.
What was the feeling back home from mother and father about this? Our David going down to the Antarctic?
Oh, well, I suppose that they looked upon it all with a certain amount of trepidation, but, I come from a seafaring family where people were always going away, so it was accepted.
What do you recall about the journey south, Dave?
What do I recall about it? I recall that all the crew got Asian flu just out of Southampton, and we had to work the ship, and I had to do engine room watch through the tropics, and that was a wake-up call for me, I can assure you.
In what way?
Hot, man. Very hot.
Very hot.
And down in a ship's engine room in the tropics, there was no air conditioning. On the Shackleton.
Who was on the ship with you that you still remember today?
Alan Cameron. Mike Crockford, who is unfortunately dead now. Mike Rhodes, Duncan Boston, Alan Gill. Quite a few others. I'm sure if I sat down, I could list quite a lot of them off. There was about 30 of us on board.
And you must have, I guess at that point, you knew which of those men was going to go to Port LaCroix with you, did you?
Oh, yes. I mean, there were three of us. There was myself, there was Mike Crockford, who was going to be the radio operator, and Alan Cameron, who was going to do IONOS search.
And did friendships form on the journey?
I'm sure they did. I'm sure they did. And that was good. We didn't stick together as such, because at that stage we were all feeling our way and we all had different interests. But by the time we reached Lockroy and we'd been through the Shackleton incident, as it were, I suppose we cemented into a little team. Mm.
You say in your book, Climate Change, that being a supernumerary on the Shackleton was irritating. What do you mean?
Well, have you ever had this holy stone, a deck, a wooden deck on a ship on your hands and knees? Have you ever come across anything more boring in your life doing that sort of work? Yeah. That sort of thing.
This was a system, wasn't it, where they paid you a certain sum of money and you had to do what they said.
A shilling per month.
A shilling a month?
Exactly. Which we never received.
Was that the source of any resentment then, or were you just glad to be having something to do?
Not resentment about the money. It was just that we were big explorers and we were expected to do menial tasks on the way. I think that's what stuck in people's throats.
Yeah.
I must admit, it stuck in a lot of people's throats far more than it stuck in mine, but I can't really answer for most of them.
Okay. You shared a cabin, didn't you, with one or two of these guys on the ship?
Oh, yes, Tony Richardson. He and I shared a cabin. Yeah. He was going to Hope Bay and doing met work, and... we quickly formed a good friendship, and he had a lot of other Met men who constantly invaded our cabin.
There's a reference in the book to the Cabin 11 Glee Club.
Oh, yes. Well, they were all sort of mountaineers, like I was a spare time mountaineer, and all had played rugby as I played rugby. You collect a repertoire of songs, you know, doing these sorts of things. And Tony Richardson was quite a good guitar player, so that was it. We used to amuse ourselves.
I was going to ask you about arriving at Stanley in 1950. It was the end of 1957, wasn't it, you sailed into Stanley?
Yes.
So what was Stanley, Port Stanley, like at that time?
Bit like Barclay. Except there were no trees.
Would you care to elaborate?
Well, I mean, it was a little country place, not much bigger than the village. Barclay wasn't much bigger than the village. It was in the back of beyond, like Stanley. I didn't feel alienated to the place at all. Hmm.
Did you have time to socialise?
Oh, well, everybody did to a certain extent, yes, because we were new faces coming in. And I think in those days they didn't see too many new faces in Port Stanley, so we got the treatment.
Well, you were young male faces, weren't you?
Well, there was that about it, I suppose, yeah. Yeah. And there were a few expats there working for FIDS and people like that.
So when a ship came in, was there a kind of ripple of excitement amongst the young ladies of the community?
Well, I don't know. Whether they were excited or not, I don't know. But, I mean, as well as our ship coming in, there was the Protector in port, and they had a much greater complement of young men than we had. So there was a bit of competition around.
So this is, I'm thinking of the dances in the town.
Ah, yes. Oh, well, they were all based around Jimmy Shand records. And all the girls would sit down one side and all the fellas would sit down the other.
And did you ever meet in the middle?
And then it was mostly Scottish reels and things like that.
Were the girls shrinking violets or were they willing to dance?
Oh, no, they get up and take us around, yes. They were pretty active in a dancing type of situation.
Then came the serious stuff of heading south. Which ship did you go down to the islands on?
On the Shackleton.
Of course, yes. And you were heading for South Georgia, weren't you?
I went to South Georgia twice. Yes, because, well, you know all about the Shackleton incident. When she...
Well, I've heard other versions of it, but I'd love to hear it from your viewpoint.
Well, my viewpoint is as in my books, you know, I said what it was. On the night that happened, the incident happened, I'd gone to bed early for no particular reason. I wanted an early night, and Tony Richardson came in and gave me a shake and said, "Dave, you better get up. We've hit a birdie bit, and the ship's taking on water, and it's all hands on deck." I thought he was joking, so I took a bit of persuading, but eventually I went up there, and sure enough, by then the ship had a list on it, and so the situation became fairly obvious.
What did you have to do? What were you instructed to do?
Well, they wanted to dump stuff because of the amount of water that was getting in. They wanted to lighten the fore end of the ship, so we were chucking stuff like anthracite over, bags of anthracite, and there was a fair amount of bagged up shingle and sand, which was going to Port Lockroy to make concrete foundations. All that got chucked overboard. Doing things like that.
Yeah, I understand the process of throwing things over the side was a bit haphazard. So were you concerned about your engines at all?
Oh, yes, but no, there was nothing like that. Nothing in a packing case, to my knowledge, went over. I was worried about the engines because... And even more so the generators and the switchboards, because they were submerged in seawater, which is not good for them.
Were you ever worried about your safety during this incident with the Shackleton?
Well, I suppose we were all concerned in a detached sort of way. We were all too busy chucking the stuff overboard. We didn't have time to get concerned. But like a lot of things... instances, things were happening which we didn't know about and were not party to. So not knowing some things could have been a bit unnerving.
So you weren't aware of the attempts to repair the ship?
Oh, yes. Yes.
What did you know? Yes.
What do we know? We know that the first officer, the mate, had a couple of goes at rigging a tarpauling around the outside of the ship like a baby's nappy to try and stop the water from getting in. Didn't work the first time, had a second go, and it worked to a certain extent then, which allowed a team of guys, the bosun and the second officer and a few of the FIDs, to go down into the hold and build a cofferdam using cement fondue, which we had on board, which was quick-setting cement, which would set in seawater. And that's what they sort of blocked the hole up. Meanwhile, the ship had sent out an SOS, and the Southern Lily turned up, which was a whale catcher and standing by us, pulled us all out of the water in case we had to jump overboard.
Did you see much of the captain, Norman Brown, at this time?
No, he was busy on the bridge.
Yeah.
Saw the first officer and Tom Woodfield, second officer. Saw lots of that. They were there and very busy and well involved. But I didn't see much of Norman Brown at all. Don't forget, I was just a lowly FID. I didn't move in such exhausted circles.
Was there any sense of panic?
Certainly not by the FIDs. We weren't in a state of panic. There was a suggestion that perhaps some of the crew were a bit panicky, but I have to admit that I didn't see any evidence of it myself.
And then you were taken on the Protector, weren't you?
Yes. The Protector came to us eventually, and they sent a couple of... shipwrights over to help with the repairs, and all us FIDs were taken off onto the Protector.
How were you transferred?
You know, I can't remember. I think we went down into the Shackleton's boat, motorboat.
The world at large was aware of this because I think the BBC World Service picked up on the story, didn't they?
Yes, well, they did. And Lou Chanter, who was correspondent for the Daily Telegraph, was on board the Shackleton with us anyway, and he was sending bulletins back. And as well as that, I suppose there were reports through the official channels, and there was quite a lot going on.
So was that generating cause and concern back home?
I suppose it was. I suppose it was. But I must admit, not a lot was said about it when I eventually got home.
The ship eventually made its way to South Georgia, and you were able to start unloading your equipment.
Well, what the situation was this, that we went to Stromness, where there was a floating dry dock, but the Shackleton, with all its cargo on board, was too heavy for the dry dock to lift. So what happened was that all the cargo had to come out of the ship, and which was a good thing because it gave me a chance to spend some time looking at the condition of the engines. I had to unpack the packing cases and pull the bits out and clean them all off with fresh water rather than seawater, and the generators were in a bit of a state because being electrical windings, they don't like being submerged in water. And what happened was that we warmed out, after drying, sluicing out and drying the generators, we put an electric bulb inside each generator to warm the air and to dry out the field windings. And they got those right. I assembled one engine and just gave it a run to make sure it was all right. And then I had to pull it to pieces again and repack it. But the switchboards were absolutely ruined.
What exactly is a switchboard?
Well, it's a board with all the instrumentation in, where the output from the generator connects to, so that we can read all the electrical indications of load and frequency and voltage and things like that. That is wired to the generators, and then it's also got circuit breakers and things like that on it. So the power is then distributed around the base or wherever it has to go.
So the generators would have been fairly useless without them.
Without the switchboard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And the switchboard was totally ruined. So fortunately, the ship got on to Secfids back in England, back in London, and they got on the phone to Listers, and Listers worked all night and all day to make new switchboards, and they were air freighted down to South America, to Montevideo. And later on in the season, the Shackleton or the Biscoe, I can't remember which, went up and collected these and brought them back down so that they could be installed.
That's quite a remarkable incident, isn't it, that they should be replaced so efficiently?
I suppose there was a little bit of the fact that the boys in the factory knew that it was me, and they all knew me, and they put their shoulders to the wheel, not to let me down, I suppose. They must have had a few thoughts about me because they filled the void spaces in the packing case with girly magazines.
Which would have made you very popular on base, I suspect.
Well, yes, I suppose so, for a while.
So you genuinely think that if it had been any other engineer, that may not have happened so swiftly?
Oh, I wouldn't like to say that.
Yeah.
But, you know, There was a lot of interpersonal relationships involved. After all, the manager of the department that made the switchboards was a relative of mine, and that might have helped.
Can I ask you a layman's question? Why was the switchboard equipment not waterproof in the first place? Would that not be normal practice?
No. I mean, most of the switchboards you buy even today, I mean, if you put them out in the weather, they get wet inside, and that's a short way to being stuffed up.
Yeah.
But Listers, being these generating sets were sort of what I would call a country house generating set, where a stately home had a bank of about three or four of these things, and they were made specially to be easily serviceable, so the switchboards were made of a big, thick zellamite, the material was, which is a sort of insulating material, mounted on a steel frame. All the wiring was exposed on the back of it, and the ironclad instrumentation was all bolted to the front. Made servicing very easy, which would have been important in a place like Port LaCroix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not the most sophisticated way of doing things.
What do you remember of your first sight of Port LaCroix when the ship came in? Was it impressive?
Oh, I'll say. I was up very early that morning as we sailed down the Neumayer Channel, and was absolutely amazed at the scenery, mountain scenery around us. And then when you turned into Port LaCroix itself, I mean, surrounded by those wonderful mountains, everywhere, every point of the compass, there was a mountain. And we had been told by those who had been to Port LaCroix before that the base hut there was considered to be a gentleman's residence, especially compared with some of the base huts that FIDS had. Mainly because I suppose it was occupied all the time. People weren't going out for long periods of time away from it. And people were made the place that they had to live 24/7 a comfortable place.
Did you get to climb any of the mountains? Because you were a member of the Gloucester Mountaineering Club, weren't you?
Oh, yes, but it wasn't really encouraged because... after all, there were only five of us there, and if an accident had happened or anything happened, then somebody else would have to do your work. And in case, and that in fact happened with Jim Muirsmith being taken ill.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we didn't take any risks. I mean, there were other things to do. We taught ourselves to become proficient at skiing, and I took a few. Trips away on the Enki Island and did some man hauling, sledging away for a few days, that sort of thing. That prevented any frustration from creeping in. And we were only a party of two of us anyway, so.
How did you adjust the idea of being a chef?
Well, I didn't mind at all, really. My mother was a qualified, I'd hate to call her a chef, but she was a qualified cook. And she'd always taught me the rudiments of cooking anyway, as a young lad. So it was no problem. I slipped into it. The only difference was I was using dehydrated materials instead of fresh.
You were also using a rather strange assay cooker, weren't you? Which had to be coaxed.
Oh, yes. If the wind was blowing, the chimney would get red hot. If there was no wind, the thing would go out just about.
And there's a story about a little disaster with a tin can.
the tin of asparagus.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen the standard FIDS issue of asparagus, but they were imported from France, quite a delicacy. Beautiful asparagus, but the tin was quite tall. Anyway, I suppose, 1 week. It was my turn to be cook, and we were going to have a tin of this asparagus as a treat, so I stuffed it in the oven, and I forgot to pierce the top. And, of course, it became a pressure vessel, and the inevitable happened. Blew the door off the oven and made a mess. It took me quite a while to see the funny side of it.
Okay, well, the first thing that had to be done, I believe, when you got to Lockroy was to build a shed for these generators.
Yes.
What do you recall of that process?
Well, it all came from prefabricated from Bolton Paul. And it was just, first of all, we had to put in the foundations, the piers, which were cement, of course, and then we built it up on that. I mean, it just wasn't me doing it. I mean, we were helped by everybody. Alan Cameron was a great help. We had a chap, Dennis Wadridge, seconded to us, who had been a builder in a previous life. He was sort of clerk of works and directed what we had to do. We got it up true and square. And what's more, it's still standing to this day, a monument to our efforts.
Was there no temptation, bearing in mind it was going to be so far from civilization, to employ FID bodge tactics on this building process?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. I don't think we deviated from the drawings one little bit. It all went together very well.
Alan Cameron talks about a tongue and groove floor he was involved in laying.
That's right. It was a wonderful job, that. He and Dennis Wadridge. The floor was diagonal tongue and grooved pine, I suppose it was. And then on top of that, they put a layer of rubberoid. And then they relayed the another diagonal floor going in the opposite direction so that the two boards were at 90 degrees to one another on top of that, and made a wonderful, strong, level, true floor.
Which was crucial because the machines would have been heavy, I guess, the generators.
Oh, well, the generators were set on huge concrete blocks that went down into the rock below. I mean, they weren't set on the floor.
Right, OK. Was it warm in there?
Well, it was. With the generators running 24/7, the place was always warm. Beautifully warm. Had a constant temperature.
Was there a temptation then later in the winter to sneak in there to stay warm?
Oh, I always found a job or two in there.
What about the other chaps?
Oh, well, yes, yeah, sometimes they come in and have a little bit of a jolly in there, yeah.
So installing the generators again from the kit of parts, was that a one-man job?
Except parts where things like the flywheels were too heavy to lift or things like that. Some parts were too heavy for one chap to lift, so I had to get help then.
But was it a fairly straightforward job, or did you hit any snags?
Well, we had snags in as much as... goodness me, we've just got a storm.
I can hear it.
It's pouring with rain. Did we hit snags? Yes. Because when we left Lister's, the flywheels particularly were all labelled with the engine number. And there were two flywheels on the engine, one at each end. And because they'd been submerged in the seawater in the Shackleton incident, it wasn't soluble. It was soluble ink, not insoluble ink, that it was written with, so we didn't know which engine, which flywheel belonged to, or flywheels belonged to. So we put them on, and we had I spent a lot of time trying to improve the cyclic irregularity by swapping the flywheels around, but we had a bit of a job to get them off. We ended up with a flicker on the lights, which was a bit of a nuisance because it affected the trace on the ionospheric equipment, and we mucked around with that for a long time, and then Alan Cameron said, what if we just run the belts a bit slacker? Just like that, you know. And I thought, well, that's a good idea. Why didn't I think of that? Anyway, we did, and it cured the problem. So that was the only problem we had.
Did Alan Cameron have engineering background?
I think he had an electrical background or in telecommunications or something.
Mm. He mentioned about one flywheel that was beginning to wander a bit, and they were concerned about it flying off.
Oh, yes. Well, the flywheels were held on with just one single key. It was a big key, mind you. And one of them worked loose, and fortunately there was about a foot or so spare crankshaft slipping out, and one day one of these flywheels started wandering towards the end. I smartly shut the engine down, of course, and replaced it.
How long do you think the whole process took to get the whole thing running properly?
Well, because we had to wait until late in the last ship of the year to get the switchboards, and all the work had to be done towards that. It was June or July before we got them running properly.
And when the switchboards arrived, they just slotted in perfectly, did they?
Well, the wiring had to be done on site. I mean, there was no prefabricated wiring.
What happened to the generators that were being replaced by the new ones?
Well, we kept one, which I installed as a standby, just in case we had a catastrophe with the listers. And I used that for pumping fuel oil, mostly. The others, I can't remember. I think one got possibly taken away to one of the other bases, and another one we stripped down and held for spare parts.
But the listers were seen as a technological advancement, were they?
Well, yeah, I suppose they were.
Why was it so important to have 24/7 power on Port Lockroy? Other bases just had it for an hour or two a day, didn't they?
Yes, that's right. Well, the thing was, it was the ionospheric business where readings were taken every hour, 24/7, and the IGI held what they called special world days, where transmissions on the ionospheric equipment were made every 15 minutes on a 24/7 basis, and this could go on for a couple of days. And that's why they had to have continuous power.
I gather from Alan Cameron that the world days are quite stressful on base.
Well, they were for the ionospheric chaps. They weren't particularly stressful for Michael Crockford and myself, he being the radio operator and I being the diesel man. I mean, I suppose some of the frustration of the ionospheric boys might have rubbed off on us. I don't know. But, of course, there were just two of those, Alan Cameron and Jack Tinberg, and doing the work of three men because Jim Muirsmith was laid up in 1958 and couldn't help in the winter.
So let's talk about him then. What do you remember of that particular episode, David?
Well, I remember that Jim didn't feel well shortly after New Year's Day, Midwinter's Day, rather. And he put himself to bed, and we wondered whether we all looked at one another and wondered whose cooking was at fault. But anyway, it got to a situation where Alan Cameron got on the radio and spoke with the doctor at Argentine Islands, Base F, who was Dr. David Jones at that stage. And well, David Jones suggested he go to bed and rest and they made, Alan Cameron, with the help of some of the others, made up a bed so that Jim could sort of lie in bed on a slope of 30 degrees.
Why was that important?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a medical man.
But presumably Dr. Jones had to diagnose a problem remotely. So how did that process
Well, he did, and from what he told us, and he told us, but he didn't tell Jim Muirsmith, that they thought he had an abscessed appendix.
Right. And that sounds quite serious, doesn't it?
Well, that's right. And anyway, we had whatever drugs were in the base medical chest that could be used, and they were used, of course, and Jim was given all the help he did, and he sort of oscillated between feeling worse and feeling better over quite a period, and then he got quite worse, quite a bit worse, and it was suggested that we try and contact the Argentinians at Almirante Brown, was the Argentinian base in over on the mainland in Paradise Harbour. And we got in touch with them by radio. Fortunately, somebody there, the base commander, spoke excellent English, and we explained the situation and asked if they would be prepared to make a boat trip to us, because they had a doctor on base. They could bring he could bring the doctor with him and all the necessary drugs and whatever else he needed. And they said they would try and make the trip, which was about, as the crow flies, it was only about 25 miles, but with deviations around the bottom of Wienke Island and Duma Island, it was further than that, longer than that.
What time of year was this, David?
Oh, well, it was in the end of winter. It was September, early September, I think. August, early September. Round about that time.
So there's plenty of ice around.
Oh, yes. It was a very hazardous journey under the circumstances.
What could you do to guide them in, so to speak?
Well, Jack Tinbergen and I did a trip to Wienke Island to get a better view over the other side of Wienke Island, to get a good view of the Gerlache Strait, and we could give them ice condition reports and things like that to give them a bit of confidence that they weren't running into dense pack ice or anything like that. So we went off to do that.
And you radioed your observations back to the Argentinians?
We took a small 68 set radio transmitter with us and radioed the situation back to Mike Crockford back in the base at Lockroy, and they in turn got in touch with the Argentinians.
And did they make a start straight away?
They had to wait for suitable weather conditions, and when they did, they got as far as the Chilean base, which is also in another part of Paradise Harbour there. And they got stuck there for a while because of ice conditions. So they had to go back home to their base and wait for better weather conditions at their end.
When do they finally arrive?
Oh, I'd have to look at my notes or look at my book.
Was it months? Was it months after?
I'd have to look at my book to tell you that. I'm not sure what the exact dates are off the top of my head.
Did it feel like months? You had to wait for months for them to get there?
Oh, no, not at all, because, you know, things were going on. Pressure was on with all the work that had to be done around the place. We just four blokes instead of five. We worried about Jim, of course, but I don't think that we were worried about time hanging on our hands waiting for the Argentinians to come.
Yeah.
But when they did set out, they got to Lockroy very quickly in the end, although they were just about knackered by the... I don't suppose I'm supposed to speak like this, seeing it's going to be kept for posterity.
Knackered's all right. I'll use that word as well, don't worry.
They were all in when they arrived, and they had to be helped back to the base because they could only land, because of ice conditions around Port LaCroix, they could only land at a further point of the island, and we had to get them in.
Was the doctor actually an Argentinian?
Well, he was an Argentinian, but he was of Japanese birth.
Right.
Dr. Mario Yagasaki or Zamazaki or something like that.
So how was communication? Did the base leader come
well,
too?
Well, there were three men that came. There were Teniente Horacio Mendez, who was the base leader, and I presume a lieutenant in the Argentinian Navy. He could speak fluent English. There was no worry. The doctor could speak Japanese or Argentinian. And the other chap, Oscar Bameter, could speak Argentinian. So the base leader, Horacio Mendez, was the go-between between the other two. And he was able to tell Jim Muirsmith what the doctor was saying, and also able to translate it into Spanish so that the doctor could understand it in his own language.
So was it at this point that Jim was told what his problem was?
I don't, not being in on the consultations, as it were, I don't know whether he was actually told or whether he just jumped to that conclusion.
Yeah. What was the Japanese doctor able to do?
Well, he had drugs, and drugs which we didn't have. Don't ask me what those drugs were, because I couldn't tell you at that stage. Probably some penicillin-type antibiotic and powerful drugs, like more powerful drugs than the ones we had.
Did they work?
Yes, they did, up to a point. I mean, it got to Jim to the stage where he could sit up for meals, and on a sunny day he could sit out with a rug around him. But, I mean, it didn't cure him by any means.
So what was the long-term solution to Jim's problem?
Well, the long-term solution, that he would have to be picked up by a ship and taken to Stanley for proper medical attention.
Hmm. Meanwhile,
which eventually happened in about November, I think.
In the meantime, you had this Argentinian party on your base and the weather closing again.
Yes, that's right. We had them for a month. Quite a house call, really. You've got to twist the doctor's arm to make a house call these days.
How was that socially for you?
Well, it was very enlightening, really. I mean, we all got on very well together, and our ways were not their ways, and their ways were not our ways, but we all learnt a lot from one another, and I think that we were all enriched by the experience.
What kind of house guests were they? Did they muck in and help out in the kitchen?
Oh, yes. Yes, very much so. Yeah. And they would do that. They brought slabs of fresh steak and things like that with them. We were living out of tins and dehydrated stuff, so it was quite a thing.
And how would you spend the evenings with them? Were there things you could do to entertain them, or vice versa?
Oh yes, there was a lot of radio ham work going on, and there was. I mean, Horacio Mendez was still the base leader at Almirante Brown, and he still had to keep in touch with those people over there, make sure that they were doing everything he needed them to do. And, we had a great supply of records and things like that, and we talk. And, yeah, it was good. I taught Oscar how to use a darkroom and use an enlarger and develop and print his own pictures, which he hadn't been able to do before. Things like that. We got on very, very well with them, really.
Yeah, I mean, technically you were enemies, weren't you?
Oh, yes, of course.
What do you think would have happened if the Argentinians had declined the invitation to help or failed to get there?
I shudder to think. Really? I really shudder to think. I don't know what would have happened. Because the drugs that we had on base were insufficient to bring about any resolution for poor old Jim. It could make him a little more comfortable, but that was all. So I don't know what would have happened, really. I don't think anybody would have ventured south from Stanley in a ship in the winter.
It kind of underlined the vulnerability, didn't it, of FID's bases in those early years where there wasn't a doctor on each base.
Well, that's right. We had no doctor. And, I mean, it wasn't long after that that the Chileans had a problem with a burst appendix on the base, and they sent a ship to act as a radio beacon for an aeroplane that flew from Santiago or somewhere with a doctor that they dropped off, but the ship sank and lost all hands. So, you know, that's the winter in Drake's Passage.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been a good thing.
So you weren't sitting there thinking, why aren't FID's doing more for us? There was nothing more that could be done.
Well, we did everything that we could do. We were young, and we didn't dwell on the pessimistic side of things. It wasn't our nature, I suppose. We were all young men.
You even built Jim a commode, I believe.
Well, Alan did, yeah. He was a great carpenter, Alan. I mean, he was good at making things like that. And he made a commode for him, yeah.
How was Jim finally got away?
Well, the protector came and took him off in the end. Yeah, and took him up to Stanley. We went in the hospital and had his appendix taken out.
Was he replaced on base?
No. No, we were managing. We'd managed all winter. So we continued managing with four men until the normal base changeover came at the end of the year.